Blog Talk Radio.
Mother's Kitchen Cheesecake, Nabisco Cookies, Rich's Pies and Cakes, and others, Quaker Oats for Apple Crisp. So I'm sure you probably saw some of your favorite things up there. So remember that a lot of these products are made by union workers. Try to support them the best that you can.
Yeah.
That's important. And made in America.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a good thing. So at least, you know, buying Chinese food, you know.
Cincinnati voters react
good, yeah.
to pension assault. Not no, but hell no.
Right. And let me go to this because that was a pretty good article. And again, you can get all this off the AFL-CIO now, Rob.
In one of the biggest working family victories in Tuesday's election, Cincinnati voters overwhelmingly defeated a city charter amendment that would have eliminated defined benefit pensions for city workers and replaced them with defined contribution plans. How overwhelming were the voters in rejecting the assault on the public pension? By a margin of 78% to 22%. Yes, only 22% of the electorate in Cincinnati, not exactly a liberal bastion, supported cutting public pensions.
That's interesting, huh?
Maybe those who are pushing the anti-pension agenda across the country should take note. As previously reported, a group of mostly out-of-state Tea Party activists, including the Liberty Initiative Fund from Virginia, succeeded in gathering enough signatures to put the initiative on yesterday's ballot. The plan, if it had passed, would have eliminated the city's pension fund for any future hires, replacing it with 401k-style private funds directed by individual employees, effectively privatizing the pension system. Many of the city employees who would have been in the new plans are not eligible for Social Security and would have had no safety net to fall back on if the stock market did poorly or they failed to successfully manage their new accounts. The plan, if it had been in place, would have forced the city to cut city services more than 40% or raise taxes and sell city assets to cover cost increases that would have resulted from the amendment. Early on, working family activists pulled together a powerful coalition that included a higher AFL-CIO, a higher association of professional firefighters,
Ohio, Progress, Ohio.
Oh, Ask Me, Council 8, Alliance for Retired Americans, NAACP, and Faith Leaders. The group quickly exposed the ballot measure for what it was, an out-of-state, foreign Tea Party initiative, and educated the public on how harmful this would be for the taxpayers, retirees, and cities, and the city's finances. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty sick. Huh?
Yeah.
National Public Pension Coalition Executive Director Jordan Marks said, via press release. Yesterday, the voters of Cincinnati stood against the Tea Party and supported secure retirement by defeating Issue 4, which would have eliminated traditional pensions. This was a vote in support of working families and a vote to ensure the workers were able to retire with dignity. Issue 4 was just one of many attacks on retirement security, and we are grateful to the real voters of Cincinnati to putting their foot down on a risky retirement scheme. I'd like to understand what people have against that. Why are they so against people retiring with a decent pension? Huh?
Apparently, they only feel that they should.
I mean, and these Tea Party crazy bastards they don't even have pensions. You know what I mean?
By the way, my grandfather was from Cincinnati.
Cincinnati?
That's what he called it, not Cincinnati.
And Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cincinnati.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Ohio.
That's the way he pronounced it.
Well, maybe he didn't know where he was from.
I think he suffered
from dementia.
No.
Dementia. In Cincinnati, Ohio.
Well, you Maine people have funny ways of talking.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. Yeah, we do. But we're not from Ohio. You know, that's pretty weird. Okay. Oh, there were some good ones here tonight, but there's some other good stuff I want to get to. But after we do this stuff, you know what it was? It was this one. And I wanted to, there was a couple, oh yeah. This troubled me in a bit, because Robert Reich, I never really could figure this guy. He was the labor secretary for Clinton, but no, he's saying that they should put minimum wage at $9 an hour and from $7.25. Mm. But I mean, really, let's face it, $10 an hour makes a lot more sense if you're gonna play with minimum wage. You know, but he said, oh, $9 an hour, you know.
What are the myths that he's saying?
Well, you know, let me show you. He's got a little video here that he drew all this stuff and stuff, but it's not, you know. Let me see if I can get it.
It's not
coming
out.
That's weird. Oh. Okay.
Here are the top four arguments for and against raising the minimum wage.
Okay, it's good for the economy. Yeah, I agree that it's good for the economy. The minimum wage is coming up for debate in Congress again soon, with mounting evidence that we're all subsidizing corporate profits with Medicaid and welfare. It's time to provide a little relief to the working poor. Here, economist Robert Reich with four important reasons to guarantee a living wage. Okay, let us move to that. This is worth listening to.
Raise the minimum wage.
Yep. Raising the minimum wage from the current rate of $7.25 an hour to $9 should be a no-brainer. It's been eroding for years. If the minimum wage had just stayed even with inflation since 1968, it would now be $10.56 an hour. Raising it to $9 is only fair. That's $18,720 a year for someone working a 40-hour work week, just above the poverty line for a family of three. And it would put more money into the hands of families that desperately need it. 15 million workers would get a pay raise, allowing them to buy more and thereby keeping others working. Besides, if workers aren't being paid enough to get out of poverty, the rest of us end up footing the bill in terms of paying for Medicaid, housing assistance, and food stamps. In other words, the rest of us make up for what their employers fail to do.
Mm-hmm.
Opponents say raising the minimum wage will cause employers to shed jobs.
Hardly.
But that's baloney. Employers are not going to outsource the jobs abroad or substitute machines for them, because jobs at this low level of pay are in the local personal service sector, retail, restaurant, hotel, and so on, where employers pass on any small wage hikes to customers as pennies more on their bills. States that have a minimum wage closer to $9 than the current federal minimum don't have higher rates of unemployment than do states still at the federal minimum. Opponents also say the raise would go mainly to high school kids working for extra money. Wrong. Nearly 90% would go to workers at least 20 years old, more than half who work full-time, and more than a quarter who are parents. Raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour. It's good for low-wage workers, it's good for the economy, and it's the decent thing to do.
Yeah. I agree with
you. If you agree, let our representatives in Washington know. Sign our petition.
Okay, folks.
I agree with that.
I agree, but...
More money in the economy, I think.
Why nine? I think when you,
because
when,
he, well, maybe
he's being fair.
No.
Well, you know, it's not fair. He said if you went to the normal
inflation, $10.40, that's what it should
that's
be.
That's what it should be. Why screw around with 9? Yeah.
Raise it to what inflation?
Yeah. It's bad rating as hell. But you know. Do this stuff, and it just is kind of crazy. You know, why? There's still, I mean, here's a guy who's a labor secretary under a Democratic, raised the rate to 9. Why don't you raise it to 10? You can raise it to 10 as easy as you can raise it to 9. You know what I mean? Right?
Yeah.
And these people a decent wage. I mean, you're still bowing if you go to 9. Biggest beneficiary of food stamps is Walmart.
Hmm.
Imagine that.
Their employees?
No, actually the people that go there, that buy from them. But as food stamps, officially known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, saw its first cuts Friday. You would think that the biggest opponent of slashing those benefits would be Walmart. The retail giant is the biggest beneficiary of the program's funds, which subsidize its workforce and provide a significant revenue stream for the company. According to the company's own calculations, Walmart takes in about 18% of the SNAP program spending. That would mean it pulled in $14 billion of the $80 billion the Department of Agriculture says was appropriated for food stamps in the year ended in September 2012. Concluded Shelley Banjo Wall Street Journal. The 18% rate is disproportionately high, considering Walmart takes in about 10% of overall sales in the United States. Walmart CEO Bill Simon is, as usual, seems clueless about what these numbers mean. He says, "I would say we're cautious but modestly optimistic. When the benefits expanded, our market share actually went down." In other words, everybody's benefits is going to get cut. Price will become more important. And when price is more important, we're more relevant. And Simon is saying that SNAP cuts will actually benefit his company, which is more than a little creepy. Waiting for people to lose benefits so that they can profit from it.
Mm-hmm.
And Daily Beast argues that Simon is misreading the numbers anyway. Even with the tailwind of expanded unemployment benefits and food stamps and 44%, 44 straight months of job growth in the U.S. economy, Walmart has been unable to increase its U.S. sales at the level of economic growth or at the level of inflation. They say the reason for sluggish Walmart sales is that the decline in real wages is far from being offset by an increase in SNAP benefits. But anyway, it's kind of odd, huh?
Yeah.
And I find it so odd to.
I didn't realize they took in so many food stamps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I guess I never really paid attention. I just noticed that our local Walmart has, they never used to carry so much food.
Oh, yeah.
Now the whole center of the store.
I wouldn't buy any food from Walmart, so it's kind of like,
no, I wouldn't either. I don't feel comfortable with that.
It's all GMO and it's all crap. And
we try to eat mostly fresh food.
If we can get it, yeah. I mean, I try to get, oh, God. Now, walking to Walmart for food is like, oh, my God. Yeah.
And we try not to eat too much processed food. But you know how it is, folks. It's more expensive when you try to do that. I'm sure people are doing the best they can to try to.
Yeah, I wasn't going to read this, but I'm like, there's a little video here. And this came up last week, and I was kind of surprised when it happened. That mother stole some food from a supermarket, and a cop who arrested her. Went arrested and decided to pay for it because she was
the kids were hungry.
Yeah,
so sad.
There is one here, but to me, what happened in Jessica Robles is true spirit of our country. When someone down to their luck, we don't throw dirt on them. We give them a leg up and a bit of a helping hand. Such a better way to go, don't you think? It's a better way to go. And let me see if I can get this video. Yeah. There we go. One mother did something illegal to help her kids, and this cop was totally unexpectedly cool. So I'm going to play this video. It's a couple minutes. The lady was caught shoplifting. The cop came in. It was a woman. And she was trying to feed her kids. And, and the cop
paid
for the food.
Oh, my God.
I love pink. Pink's my favorite.
Our favorite.
We be ready for pink.
Introducing new raspberry. Desperate times call for desperate measures.
My brother and I are asking for food. We told him to here.
Jessica Robles, a single mother of three, says she did what she had to for her kids last month when she almost walked out of this Publix with $300 of groceries without paying. Miami-Dade officer Vicki Thomas stopped her and charged her with a misdemeanor, but that would be the beginning of the story.
I made the decision to buy her some groceries because arresting her wasn't going to solve the problem with her children being hungry.
Officer Thomas says it was about $100 worth of food for her family. The story aired on 7 News Monday, making national headlines.
Barred a mother down on her luck, three hungry kids, no money, made a bad choice. She went to a grocery.
Since, people all over South Florida have been calling, wanting to help. Tuesday, Jessica met some of those people.
You have $700, $200 personal for me, and $500 from Restoration One of Miami. You can pick up anything you want.
I don't even know where to begin.
She has three kids, they have food, and, you gotta help out sometimes.
I've been there. I have plenty of time when I have to send my kids with just a glass of water to school.
And Restoration One of Miami says if there's any money left over after all of these groceries from that $700, they're going to hand over Jessica some cash, too.
You have $271, okay?
And from groceries to a job, another 7 News viewer called to say he had an opening he wanted to consider Jessica for. Jessica wasted no time.
I did bring my resume for you.
Awesome. Thank you.
John Challoner of PhoneDoctor.com, a Miami company that specializes in office phone systems, interviewed Jessica.
And we'll be doing customer service, answering phones, taking messages.
And hired her on the spot.
I'd like you to start Monday if that's possible.
Now, Jessica says her 2, 5, and 12-year-olds will never go hungry again, thanks to a few good people in the world.
There's no words I can tell you right now how grateful I am, that you took your time and helped somebody out, especially somebody like me.
Jennifer Bisram, 7 News.
She maybe got it in better times. She don't know.
She had a huge tattoo on her. I couldn't afford a tattoo like that.
Well, maybe she got it in a better time when, now she has three kids.
Yeah.
I don't
even
know when she got
it. Who knows, Lila.
But anyway, it was really nice.
That she had that.
It was really nice that people stepped up and helped her.
Yeah, it was.
And now she has a job.
Yeah.
Make a go of it, keep her head above water.
Yeah. So anyway, for all of you who, kind of rough though. I mean, she was stealing $300 worth of food.
It adds up fast. She has three kids.
I know.
A couple of boxes of cereal, some milk.
I'm sure I'm not. Yeah, I can't understand. So what do we got here? I thought we got some more stuff. Let's do some more of this economic stuff, and then we'll go to some other things. Okay, 'cause I thought that was kind of interesting.
there was something there. Trade agreement. Go down. Trade agreement reveals how life will be organized in 2050.
Yeah,
that should
kinda,
be interesting.
That's kind of freaky. That was kind of freaky. I don't like it very much. I hate these, that's 30 years from now, 30, 40 years from now.
Well, an interesting thought.
Yeah, but I don't like being pre-planned like that. Because I read something that by 2050, two-thirds of the world population was expected to be reduced.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The United States is negotiating two huge problematic trade agreements. One with Europe, which is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and another with countries around the Pacific, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Both dramatically extend the North American Free Trade Agreement model.
Well, that hasn't helped us,
no,
free
not
trade.
At all. First, I am 100% in favor of trade. Whoever this writer is, I don't know.
Doesn't mean he's in the
band, for sure. All right. Everyone I know wants good trade policies that raise living standards around the world. Well, equally, I oppose trade policies that weaken civil society and harm communities. In simple terms, trade agreements are about trade, export, and imports. However, these trade agreements also serve as political, social, cultural, and moral documents, which set political and social standards for countries and communities. These trade agreements regulate countries in the same way that our Constitution regulates Congress, our courts, the President, and our state governments. However, the substance, the value in our Constitution are very different from values expressed in trade agreements. Our Constitution grants extensive political rights and social protection to people and communities. Our Constitution never mentions corporations, not once.
Uh-huh. No.
So, anyway. But anyway, that's from the AFL-CIO.
But we didn't see what the trade agreement...
I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's that long, blown-out thing. I'm going to go to... let's go here.
I think it looks very important, too.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you think so, let's go to that. I don't think it was worth reading an entire trade agreement.
Well, maybe they have a short synopsis at the end.
No, they didn't really. It was a complete trade agreement.
Okay.
Pacific and Atlantic.
Yeah, I wanted to see the summary. They didn't have a summary. That
no,
didn't help
it,
us.
No, it just goes to the trade agreement.
Mm.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, anyway, I wanted to go to... hang on. So, anyway. So annoying.
Mm-hmm.
So annoying. There. Okay. Okay. Obama, okay. Yeah, we're working on here, folks. It won't take long. In fact, why don't we go to a quick music break and we'll pick out an article?
That would be great.
That would be a good idea. Okay. Let's do some... since we're talking about food stamps and stuff, let's go to All You Can Eat. There we go. article here we got from the Minuteman News. It's called, administration decides Obamacare exchanges are exempt from anti-kickback law. Interesting, huh?
Hmm.
The Affordable Health Care Act is the biggest new health care program in decades, but the Obama administration has ruled that neither the federal insurance exchange nor the federal subsidies paid to insurance companies on behalf of low-income people are federal health care programs.
What does that mean?
I know. The surprise decision disclosed last week exempts subsidized health insurance from a law that bans rebates, kickbacks, bribes, and certain other financial arrangements in federal health programs, stripping law enforcement of a powerful tool used to fight fraud in other health care programs like Medicare.
Hmm.
Interesting. So the main purpose of the anti-kickback law, as described by federal courts in score of the Medicare cases, is to protect patients and taxpayers against the undue influence of money on medical decisions. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, disclosed her interpretation of the law in a letter to Representative Jim McDermott, Democrat of Washington, who had asked her views, and she did not explain the legal rationale for her decision, which followed a spirited debate within the administration. Under the Affordable Health Care Act, millions of people will be able to buy insurance from qualified health plans offered on exchanges or marketplaces run by federal government and by some states. But most of the buyers are expected to be eligible for subsidies to make insurance more affordable. The subsidies paid directly to insurers from the United States Treasury start in January and are expected to total more than $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, Mrs. Zabilas said the Health and Human Service Department does not consider the subsidies to be federal health care programs. She, this is insane. She reached the same conclusion with respect to federal and state exchanges, but with federal money and with respect to federally funded consumer assistance programs, including the counselors known as navigators who help people shop for insurance and enroll in government through the exchanges.
That doesn't make
sense.
Any sense to
it
me.
It makes no sense at all.
Well,
yeah.
Well, you heard her before Congress.
She
made no sense at all.
I mean, she's totally brain dead. Yeah.
So you have no protection.
It seems like you don't. Most of the buyers are expected to be eligible for subsidies to make insurance more affordable. The subsidies paid directly to insurers from the United States Treasury start in January, expected to total more than $1 trillion over 10 years.
Ms. Sebelius and the Health and Human Services Department does not consider the subsidies to be federal health care programs. She reached the same conclusion with respect to federal and state exchanges built with federal money and with respect to federally funded consumer assistance programs, including the counselors known as navigators who help people shop for insurance. It doesn't make sense to me.
The federal exchange.
You just read that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But it was worth reading again because we were wondering how the hell
but
is
it
not be a federal program.
I wouldn't read any more.
Well, the federal exchange has been plagued with problems since it opened on October 1st. The Obama administration said that the online enrollment system for the exchange was out of service again for 90 minutes on Monday afternoon in an unscheduled outage.
Hmm.
That was...
In addition to the scheduled downtime from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. each day.
President Obama,
speaking at a political event on Monday night,
scheduled downtime from 1 to 5 a.m.
It's closed, in other words. And he was determined to fix the problems that have frustrated millions of people trying to use the websites for the federal exchange. When the unexpected happens, when the unanticipated happens, we're just going to work on it, Mr. Obama said. We're going to fix these things that aren't working the way they should be. We're going to smooth this out, and we're just going to keep on going.
You know, only two-thirds of this country have internet access. Did you know that?
So what are the rest supposed to do?
I mean, they're living out in the farmlands and all these places. A lot of towns out west don't even have internet, cell towers and things like that.
Well, they could get satellite internet.
or they don't have them. They really don't. So I mean, we're, our system is, our grid is really sad. All right, you don't, you know, you think people got it, but they don't. President Obama was speaking on a political event on Monday night, said he was determined to fix the problem, and that frustrated millions of people.
I just read that.
Okay. When the unexpected happens.
We just read that. Lawyers and law enforcement officials said Mrs. Sebelius' decision was unexpected because the insurance exchanges and subsidy payments appeared to fit the definition of federal health care programs in the anti-kickback statute. Generally, the law makes it a crime to pay or receive anything of value in return for the referral of patients or as an inducement for people to buy goods and services reimbursed by federal health care programs. Such programs are broadly defined as any plan or program that provides health benefits, whether directly, through insurance, or otherwise, which is funded directly in whole or in part by the United States government. The Secretary's decision will have some very significant consequences, said D. McCarthy Thornton, former Chief Counsel to the Inspector General at the Health and Human Services Department. The federal anti-kickback statute will, in most cases, not apply to subsidized health plans or the items and services furnished by these plans.
That's very strange. And plans and providers are very happy to be relieved of that concern. Sure they are. they can kick kickbacks and referrals all they want. And Kevin G. McCanney, a lawyer who specializes in health care fraud and abuse cases, said Ms. Avila's decision would allow drug companies to give coupons to people who buy insurance through the exchanges. Such coupons subsidize co-payment and reduce out-of-pocket costs for consumers, encouraging them to use certain brand-name prescription drugs when lower-cost alternatives are available. The federal government has forbidden the use of drug coupons in Medicare and other federal health programs, saying they amount to a classic kickback scheme, with drug companies paying consumers to use their product. But they allow it in, they're allowing it in Obamacare. Yeah. President, this thing is so stupid. It's so criminally stupid.
It's made for insurance companies.
It's totally made for insurance
and pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, exactly. Coupons may drive down the copayment for an expensive brand-name drug, but often the insurer must pay much more than it would be for a generic version of the medication. This thing goes on. But addressing a rally of supporters on Monday, Mr. Obama responded to critics who say he has broken his promise that people could keep their health insurance if they liked it. Mr. Obama provided some additional explanation. Now, if you have or have one of these plans before the Affordable Health Care came into law and you really like the plan, what he said was you could keep it if it hasn't changed since the law was passed. In recent weeks, hundreds of thousands of people have received notices discontinuing individual policies because they did not meet minimum coverage standards under the health care law. So, you know, Obama and his whole administration are nothing but crooks and thieves and lying bastards. Unbelievable. And we'll see this, I tell you. Made in China, kitchen appliance is found to contain hidden Wi-Fi circuitry that installs malware.
Huh?
Can you imagine that? GMO labeling issued in 522 seems to have failed. This in California, I think. So many. What do you think?
Yeah.
Let's see what we got. We've got one more. This was an interesting article. A little long, but I'll read a little bit about it. It's from Chris Hedges, who I kind of like.
Is there a revolution coming? Americans finally realize global capitalism is a monstrous sham.
A murderous sham,
excuse me.
Popular revulsion for the ruling elite is nearly universal. Are we going to see an uprising?
I think we will. It's a matter of time. They're so greedy.
Did you ever ask yourself how it happens that governments and capitalism continue to exist in spite of all the evil and trouble they are causing in the world? The anarchist Alexander Berkman wrote in his essay, The Idea of the Thing, you did, then your answer, if you did, then your answer must have been that it is because the people support those institutions and that they support them because they believe in them. Well, Berkman was right. As long as most citizens believe in the idea that justified global capitalism, the private and state institutions that serve our corporate markets are unassailable. When these ideas are shattered, the institutions that buttress the ruling class deflate and collapse. The battle of ideas is percolating below the surface, and it is a battle that corporate state is steadily losing. An increasing number of Americans are getting it. They know that we have been stripped of political power. They recognize that we have been shorn of our most basic and cherished civil liberties and live under the gaze of the most intrusive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. And half the country lives in poverty. Many of the rest of us, if the corporate state is not overthrown, will join them. These truths are no longer hidden. Would you like to read some of this?
It's actually too small for me to see.
If you can make it larger.
Yeah, that's a little
better.
If you can move.
Okay.
Okay.
Lila will be reading a little.
It appears
that
public ferment is dormant in the United States. This is incorrect. The ideas that sustain the corporate state are swiftly losing their efficacy across the political spectrum. The ideas that they are rising to take the place, however, are in... I don't know that word. The right has retreated into Christian fascism and a celebration of the gun culture. That's true. The left, knocked off balance by decades of fierce state repression in the name of anti-communism, is struggling to rebuild and define itself. Popular revulsion for the ruling elite, however, is nearly universal. It is a question of which ideas will capture the public's imagination. Revolution usually erupts over events that would, in normal circumstances, be considered meaningless or minor acts of injustice by the state. But once the tinder of revolt has piled up, as it has in the United States, an insignificant spark easily ignites popular rebellion. No person or movement can ignite this tinder. No one knows where or when the eruption will take place. No one knows the form it will take. But it is certain now that popular revolt is coming. The refusal by the corporate state to address even the minimal grievances of the citizenry, along with the abject failure to remedy the mounting state repression, the chronic unemployment and underemployment, the massive debt peonage that is crippling more than half of Americans, and the loss of hope and widespread despair means that blowback is inevitable. Because revolution is evolution at its boiling point, you cannot make a real revolution any more than you can hasten the boiling point of a tea kettle. Berkman wrote, "It is the fire underneath that makes it boil. How quickly it will come to the boiling point will depend on how strong the fire is." Revolution, when they erupt, appear to the elites and the establishment to be sudden and unexpected. This is because the real work of revolutionary ferment and consciousness is unseen by the mainstream society, noticed only after it has been largely completed. Throughout history, those who have sought radical change have always had to first discredit the ideas used to prop up the ruling elites and construct alternative ideas for society. Ideas often embodied in the utopian revolutionary myth. The articulation of a viable socialism as an alternative to corporate tyranny, as attempted by the book Imagine Living in a Socialist USA and the website Popular Resistance, is for me paramount. Once ideas shift for a large portion of population, once the vision of a new society grips the popular imagination, the old regime is finished.
Yeah, no, it's true.
We'll go to the next page.
I really appreciate what he said on that. And an uprising that is devoid of ideas and vision is never a threat to ruling elite. Social upheavals without clear definition and direction, without ideas behind it, descend into nihilism, random violence and chaos. It consumes itself. This is its core. This is why I disagree with some
elements
of
the
Black
Bloc anarchist.
Can I continue?
Yeah, but you keep...
I burped. Sorry. I believe in strategy, and so did many anarchists, including Berkman, Emma Goldman, I don't know this guy's name, Proctor or Crofton.
And Mikhail Bakunin.
Bakunin. Okay.
By the time the ruling elites are openly defied, there has already been nearly total loss of faith in the ideas. In our case, free market capitalism and globalization that sustain the structures of the ruling elite. And once enough, people get it, a process that can take years. The slow, quiet, and peaceful social evolution becomes quick, militant, and violent, as Berkman wrote. Evolution becomes revolution. This is where we are headed. I do not say this because I am a supporter of revolution. I prefer the piecemeal and incremental reforms of a functioning democracy. I prefer a system which our social institutions permit the citizenry to nonviolently dismiss those in authority. I prefer a system in which institutions are independent and not captive to corporate power. But we do not live in such a system. We vote as the only option left. Ruling elites, once the ideas that justify their existence are dead, resort to force. It is their final clutch at power. If a nonviolent popular movement is able to ideologically disarm the bureaucrats, civil servants, and police to get them, in essence, to defect, nonviolent revolution is possible. But if the state can organize effective, prolonged violence against dissent, it spawns reactive revolutionary violence, or what the state calls terrorism. Violent revolution usually gives rise to revolutionaries as ruthless as their adversaries. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process, excuse me, he does not become a monster, Friedrich Nietzsche wrote. And if you gaze long enough into the abyss will gaze back into you. Violent revolutions are always tragic. I and many other activists seek to keep our uprising nonviolent. We seek to spare the country the savagery of domestic violence by both the state and its opponents. There is no guarantee that we will succeed, especially with the corporate state controlling a vast internal security apparatus and a militarized police force. But we must try. Corporations freed from all laws, government regulations, and internal constraints are stealing as much as they can, as fast as they can, on the way down. The managers of corporations no longer care about the effects of their pillage. Many expect the system they are looting to fall apart. They are blinded by personal greed and hubris. They believe their obscene wealth can buy them security and protection. They should have spent a little less time studying management in business school and a little more time studying human nature and about human history. They're digging their own grave.
And it says, our shift to corporate totalitarianism, like the shift to all forms of totalitarianism, is incremental. Totalitarian systems ebb and flow, sometimes taking one step back before taking two steps forward, and they erode democratic liberalism. This process is now complete. The consent of the governed is a cruel joke. Barack Obama cannot defy corporate power any more than George W. Bush or Bill Clinton could. Unlike his two eminent predecessors, Bush, who was intellectually and probably emotionally impaired, did not understand the totalitarian process abetted by the presidency. Because Clinton and Obama and their Democratic Party understand the destructive roles they played and are playing, they must be seen as far more cynical and far more complicit in the ruination of the country. Now, I've said this myself, but, you know, the Democrats are horrendous. Okay. Democratic political politicians speak in the familiar, I feel your pain language of the liberal class, while allowing corporations to strip us of personal wealth and power. They are effective masks for corporate power. The corporate state seeks to maintain the fiction of our personal agency in the political and economic process. As long as we believe they are participants in lies sustained through massive propaganda campaigns, endless and absurd election cycles, and the pageantry of empty political theater, our corporate oligarchs rest easy in their private jets, boardrooms, and penthouses and mansions. As the bankruptcy of corporate capitalism and globalization is exposed, the ruling elite are increasingly nervous. They know that if the ideas that justify their power die, they are finished. This is why voices of dissent, as well as spontaneous uprisings such as the Occupy movement, are ruthlessly crushed by the corporate state.
Hmm.
Did you want to read the last paragraph?
Many ideas once held to be true have come to be grouted as wrong and evil, Berkman wrote in his essay. Thus the ideas of the divine right of kings, of slavery and serfdom. There was a time when the whole world believed those institutions to be right, just, and unchangeable, in the measure that those superstitions and false beliefs were fought by advanced thinkers. They became discredited and lost their hold upon the people, and finally the institutions that incorporated those ideas were abolished. Highbrows would tell you that they had outlived their usefulness and therefore they died. But how did they outlive their usefulness? To whom were they useful, and how did they die? We know already that they were useful only to the master class, and they were done away with by popular uprisings and revolutions.
There you go, folks. And that was on, you can get that on Alternet.
That was by Chris Hedges.
Yeah. And,
I agree with his essay.
Yeah, he was a big supporter of Occupy.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of just faded away out what happened to it.
Well,
got infiltrated, we know that.
Got torn apart.
I think there'll be another movement out of that.
I'm hoping so. Johnson & Johnson is to pay $2.2 billion for making false marketing claims and engaging in kickbacks. Imagine that. And yet, Obamacare, and yet Obamacare is allowing kickbacks
mm-hmm.
right, to the pharmaceuticals. This is from Natural News. In what considered one of the largest healthcare fraud settlements and one of the largest whistleblower payouts in U.S. history, Johnson & Johnson will pay $2.2 billion to settle charges involving a company's role in marketing three prescription drugs for unapproved uses. As the saying goes, but wait, there's more.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson & Johnson, along with two subsidiaries, Janssen Pharmaceuticals and Cytos, also paid kickbacks to doctors and nursing homes who touted their drugs, created elder care sales forces who were paid to push the drug and sent pharmacists to hospitals to assess patient records. Three drugs inappropriately marketed and given to patients.
Mm.
The case involves false marketing and other claims regarding
Risperidone,
the FDA-approved drug specifically for the use of schizophrenia.
I've seen that used on kids.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
However, it was marketed by Johnson & Johnson to nursing home professionals and physicians for treating patients with dementia. In other cases, another antipsychotic drug, Invega, was also inappropriately marketed and prescribed. Have you seen that one?
No.
Invega? Okay. Additionally, Natricor, an FDA-approved drug for people with heart failure, was marketed and ultimately given to patients. However, it was given to people who had significantly less severe heart failure that did not render it necessary to take the drug in the first place. And according to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, Johnson & Johnson and their two subsidiaries line their pockets at the expense of American taxpayers, patients, and private insurance industry. He goes on to say that they recklessly put at risk the health of some of the most vulnerable members of our society, including young children, the elderly, and the disabled. But Big Pharma trusts still remain in question. Johnson & Johnson, now CEO Alex Gorsky, in an effort to move forward post-settlement promises to provide patients worldwide with innovative solutions, However, the optimistic words evoked concerns over many, including Patrick Burns, co-director of Advocacy Group, Taxpayer Against Fraud.
Stockholders
and patients will pay the price for the fraud, he says. Mr. Gorski, however, gets to keep his job at Johnson & Johnson and all of his bonuses.
This is a gigantic settlement that reflects the seriousness of the criminal and civil allegations against Johnson & Johnson over Respidol and other drugs, says Carl Tobias, who teaches product liability law at the University of Richmond Law School. That's sad.
Very sad.
They paid a big fine, but obviously it wasn't that much to
them. They probably made
trillion.
$20 billion.
Or a trillion.
Yeah, who knows. It's really sick, huh? Really sick. Let me see what else I can come up here. We've got about 3 minutes. Goodness.
Let's look at...
Socialized medicine is a keystone to the arch of socialized state. That was said by, I believe, what was he there? Stalin or Hitler? Lenin. Vladimir Lenin said that. Socialized medicine is the keystone to the arch of socialized state. Here, folks, by Obamacare. And, let's see. Okay, one more before we go. Anybody know Elizabeth Vargas? She's on ABC.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of little gossipy news.
What happened with
she
her?
She kind of took over my favorite,
Amy
Robach?
Mm-hmm.
On GMA, okay? And she was replacing her every other week, so nobody got too addicted to Amy. But poor Elizabeth, turns out, that has been off your television screen for a few weeks. And now the Daily News reports that it's because she's been in rehab for alcohol abuse. They cited a source close to Vargas saying that she's been in an undisclosed rehab facility for several weeks and plans to remain there for another few weeks. The anchor and reporter confirmed the news herself, releasing a statement. Like so many people, I'm dealing with addiction. I realized I was becoming increasingly dependent on alcohol. I feel fortunate to have recognized it for a problem that was becoming. I'm in treatment and am so thankful to the love and support of my family, friends, and colleagues at ABC News. And like so many others, I will deal with this challenge one day at a time. If coming forward today gives one another person the courage, and I'm grateful. We are proud of the steps Elizabeth has taken to the pulling in her recovery. We said, ABC spokesman said, we look forward to having her back home at ABC News, where she has done so much distinguished work over the years. Elizabeth is a member of our family, and we will support her in every way we can. Yeah, so anyway, I just thought I'd mention that.
Okay.
Because, you know, I don't think she's going to take the job of Amy. I'm kind of a big Amy Robach fan. So anyway. That's about it, folks. So it's 9 o'clock, and it's Wednesday night, and we thank you for joining us.
And we say good night.
Yeah.
I hope you stay tuned tomorrow night and listen to Leo as he talks and
brings you into the spiritual area.
We
usually go into a spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm going to try to do that tomorrow.
So have a good night, folks, and take care of yourselves.
Good night, everybody, and thanks for joining us.
Remember to be good to yourself. It's important.